Hello and welcome to This Way Up. In this series, I talk to a number of leading women in the creative industry, talking specifically about the good, the bad, and the ugly of their careers. For this episode, I interview Yomi Adekoke. I first came across Yomi through her amazing book, Slay in Your Lane, which she co-wrote with Elizabeth Uvi Benene. Slay in Your Lane is an absolute must read. From education to work to dating, this inspirational, honest and provocative book recognizes and celebrates the strides Black women have already made, whilst providing practical advice for those who want to do the same and forge a better, visible future. The book is filled with stories from both Elizabeth and Yomi's own lives, as well as interviews from dozens of the most successful Black women in Britain, including BAFTA award-winning director Amma Asante, British Vogue publisher Vanessa Kingori, CEO of GroupM Karen Blackett, and Olympic gold medalist Denise Lewis. Sheryl Sandberg of Facebook describes the book as a gift for anyone who wants to better understand what Black women and girls are up against and the tremendous resources they draw upon as they make their way in the world. Yomi is a busy lady. Alongside her book, she also writes for The Observer, The Independent, and hosts her own podcast with Elizabeth. So as you can imagine, during our conversation, we covered a lot. Yomi opens up about the importance of putting herself first and taking a year out of university due to depression. We also discuss how during that same year she struggled to find work placements, so instead she decided to create her very own magazine. It was through this significant year that she found her passion as a journalist. And finally, she reveals the inspirational and practical advice on how she launched her book, Slay in Your Lane. I'm not going to reveal too much about our conversation, as it is much better if you hear it straight from Yomi. So, without further ado, this is This Way Up, and this is Yomi Adekoke. So Yomi, welcome to the show.
Hi.
I'm so excited to interview you. I have been aware of you and your amazing book, Slay in Your Lane, for a very long time now. And I would love to get into all of that. But before I do, as usual with the podcast, I would love to start with the very beginning of your life.
I was born in a hospital called Newham General.
Okay, very specific.
I was trying to find out my birth chart the other day.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I know that, like, I was born at like 10 past one or something. So I was doing it for like an astrology thing.
And did you grow up around there?
No, actually. I lived in Canning Town till I was two. I have no recollection of it. And then okay. I moved up Styx, and we moved to Croydon when I was 2 years old, where I've lived ever since.
Amazing. So Croydon girl through and through. What was it like growing up in Croydon?
I am definitely a Croydon supremacist. I love Croydon, and completely non-ironically, I think, you know, Croydon gets a really bad rap, but I have never been much of like a city girl, and I always loved that Croydon completely like its own world, like it's all encompassing. We have everything you need here, and I've just always really liked it. It's a super diverse borough. I think it has like the highest Caribbean or Jamaican population in the UK. It's super, super diverse. And I honestly like have always loved it.
I love it. It's great, especially for the shopping.
Absolutely. I really, really I'm a Croydon fan and have like no intention of leaving. And I think growing up, like it was a mixed bag, however, because I had a great childhood in Croydon, but I remember definitely in the sort of early aughts, you know, there definitely was maybe between like 2005 to 2008, quite like a serious spike in terms of like youth violence in my area. Like it was like in my teenage years, every other day, there'd be a stabbing. Like it was ridiculous.
Oh God.
Yeah. You didn't get kind of scared to like, I remember like, you got scared to sit in particular parts of the bus because it was like, if you sit too far near the back, then you might get like your phone stolen. If you sit like, I don't know, if you're not, you had to be very strategic. And like, there was this whole craze called like happy slapping where like kids
would
slap other kids and like, what's the word? Like record it on their phone. This is when like smartphones.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, you remember that. So a little bit ropey at times, but that all being said, Croydon's just, honestly, I think like we're responsible for like Kate Moss, Stormzy, Goldie. Was it Goldie? No, I think we're responsible for drum and bass as an actual genre. Like a lot of amazing things have come out of the borough. So yeah, I had a great childhood here, man. I just think it was very creative and diverse.
That's amazing. It is a great borough. I've been there. Like I said, I love my shopping. I know what you mean. Like some people do think, oh, you know, it's Croydon, but I've not seen it that way.
Yeah.
But from there, so I was sort of reading up about you, of course, and you went to Warwick University.
I did, yes.
How was that as an experience?
Gosh, I mean, so obviously coming from my area, I went to, you know, a predominantly white secondary school. It was still a state school, but like Croydon's a massive borough and it had like a massive catchment area. So you had like lots of like working class white kids, working class black kids, then like middle class black kids, middle class white kids. So it was quite, again, a mixed bag. And then I'd still be coming home to a, you know, very diverse and like working class community. So when I, you know, and that was similar to for my college as well. Like, you know, even I'd say my college was even blacker, but like, getting to Warwick, like, I guess it was a massive culture shock. Like, not only was it super white, but it was very, very posh. I honestly understood that, like, private school was a thing, but I guess I'd never politicized. I kind of just thought, okay, private school, some people's parents pay for them to go to school. Weird, okay. But I guess getting to Warwick, it's like, also, this is why they pay, because, like, you know, it gains them access to institutions like these where I guess the, you know, that's part, it's almost like a birthright for a lot of like students. Whereas like for me and like my friends that were from like South London that went to Warwick, we weren't necessarily expected to be in an institution like that. And it was so middle class that like, even the like, you know, there was a very small black population, but most of the black kids that were there were privately educated. We met like Nigerian students who had come over from Nigeria and like, obviously to go to an institution like Warwick, like they were often super rich. Like they made the white middle-class kids look like peasants because they were like actually like properly like millionaires and like
really millionaires. Wow.
Yeah. And so that was interesting, an interesting dynamic, like meeting these like super rich Nigerians and stuff who would also say things like, you're not a real Nigerian. And then also, cause obviously we weren't like born there, but then also were like massively classist. So it was, yeah, culture shock from all angles. Like, it just made me think, rethink a lot.
Yeah, and for those who don't know Warwick University, it's like one of the top five, I want to say. It's a really, really good university, right?
Changes. It slips up and down that.
Okay.
That it's usually within the top 10 to 5. But yeah, it's a great uni.
So you kind of knew that you were going to get like amazing education, but at the same time, it was just not a really great atmosphere is what it sounds like.
Yeah, it was like, I mean, it was difficult because like I had some of the best years of my life at Warwick, but I just don't think I'd ever been so outside of my comfort zone. Even at school, I guess, like, because as I said, Croydon's enormous. So you have, you know, the kind of rougher areas of like West Croydon, which is where I grew up. But then you also have, there's a Millionaires Row in Purley. Like, so you had these kids that were well off at my secondary school as well. However, it wasn't to the degree that I felt like totally alienated. Sometimes I'd feel a little bit like, oh, I want those trainers and I can't get them. That was kind of the extent of it, and you know, things like that. But I think with Warwick it was like, whoa, like, you know, as I said, the super rich Nigerians, like whilst we were, you know, the same race, they'd grown up in Nigeria where like race wasn't necessarily as big a factor in their lives as it was for me. So, but also that, I guess what they found it easier to have things in common, for instance, with like the middle-class white people, because they all had money. So it was like, they
yeah.
And they were all like, they just go off and all play lacrosse. Whereas like, you know, I guess like me having Nigerian heritage, didn't really mean much to Nigerian super rich people that also didn't really necessarily see me as Nigerian, because I couldn't even speak, you know, Yoruba or any other like Nigerian like language. So yeah, I think it was like I had an amazing time and I made lifelong friends there. But I just think that as much as the race element was very alienating, mm-hmm. being one of a few black students there, the class stuff was like crazy, because it was just like, I mean, as a student as well, like your financial situation is very often like exacerbated.
Of course. If
you're broke before, it's like you're super broke at uni. So yeah, it was like a real eye opener.
And in terms of like preparing you for work life, did it help you at all? Or did you find that you had to find some inspiration elsewhere?
Oh, it definitely helped me. It helped absolutely.
Right.
I had no reason to know how to code switch pre-uni. Like, so as in like, you know, speaking, for instance, differently based on like who you're with and like what surroundings you're in. I had no reason to do that before. I mean, I've always been told I'm a bit like, I don't know, like I've always been told I speak like not, I could not say plummy, because like, I don't hear myself as posh in any way, but even at school, people always said I spoke a particular way that made them think I was posher than I was.
I actually really know what you mean, because I sound really posh, but I grew up in France in the suburbs, actually like the equivalent of Croydon near Paris. And everyone thinks I'm really posh, but it's really because I wanted to fit in. Yeah. So I know exactly what you mean.
Exactly. So like I always spoke a particular way anyway, and like people would be like, oh, you're like, in my area would say that I was posh. And then it's like, I went to Warwick and it's like, the minute I open my mouth, it's like, oh, you're from South London then. And it's like, oh, really? Like, I didn't hear like my own accent. And I think I had no reason to think about it or think about anything. I think that's what going to work made me realize, like how much I'd kind of blustered my way through life without having to think about like the reality statistically of like, you know, being black, being from a working class background, female, what that would mean for me in terms of like my career prospects. I'd never thought of it. And then I got to uni.
Yeah.
Like, oh, wow. Like, so in reality, in these institutions, the ethnic makeup, the gender makeup, the class makeup is primarily people that look nothing like you, sound nothing like you. So yeah, I definitely picked up a lot of skills. Like, you know, pre-university, most of my friends were black, and from working class backgrounds, but meeting lots of different types of people at uni meant that when I had to go into a workplace, which was, funny enough, pretty much the exact same makeup in terms of being very, you know, white and middle class, I felt less blindsided than I did when I got to uni. Like, whoa, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. That's the one thing that people don't really teach you before you get to uni, is actually it doesn't just prepare you in terms of the course that you're doing, but it also prepares you mentally on how to sort of, I don't know, yeah, deal with the day-to-day of work life. And as you said, the kind of the fact that you've got these type of people that you've had to meet there that you wouldn't have met maybe in Croydon, maybe, or where you were.
Exactly that.
And so did you find it easy to find a job, or how did it go from there?
Oh my gosh. So when I was at uni, I was studying law. I really didn't like it. I realized that very, very early, thankfully. But I had absolutely no idea what I wanted to do. Like, most of the black students who I used to hang around with, primarily like Afro-Caribbean society members, most of them, if they weren't studying law, they were studying engineering or something. Like, you know, there's that sort of myth, not even myth, to be honest, there is that sort of like thing about being like a second generation immigrant child and your parents very much being like, you have to be a doctor, a lawyer. Yeah, and there was a lot of that at uni. So I met a lot of like my friends studying law, and a lot of them have gone on to like be lawyers, or if not, they went on to corporate careers. So I initially thought that's what I need to be doing. So I remember like literally doing a phone interview with Barclays, and like just whilst doing it, knowing I had absolutely no chance. Like, it was just so not me. Like, I didn't know what I was talking about. I'm like the least corporate person. Like, maths. This math is like the only like subject I really flunked. So I was just like, what am I doing? And like, but I gave it a go because it's what everyone was doing. And then that became very clear, became apparent very soon that that wasn't a trajectory I was going to go down. So eventually, after, to really condense a very long story, like, I struggled a lot at uni. I ended up taking a year out because I was like depressed. And then on my year out, I started a blog where I just kind of like, I don't know, like just moan about things that I thought, you know, I don't know, that were bothering me, or just like wax lyrical about something I thought was great. I just used to write a lot of rubbish. And this guy that I was talking to, again, white middle-class guy, privately educated, he kind of said to me, like, you do realize, like, he used to read my blog, and he messaged me and said, like, you do realize that you could get paid to do this. Like, it's literally opinion journalism. And like, it never even crossed my mind. Like, my sister being a journalist, it never crossed my mind that like I could be a journalist, because her journey in journalism was very, very difficult. And like, she graduated during the last recession. So she'd really struggled. So I'd like completely not even, I just like completely blocked that out as a career prospect.
Right.
And I, and bar my sister, who was really struggling at that time, she's doing amazingly now, but she was really struggling. I hadn't thought, there were very few black female journalists that I could name on the British landscape at that
time. Yeah, it's still the case, unfortunately.
Absolutely still the case, especially in staff, especially with reporters. So I was like, oh, okay, I guess I could give that a go. So whilst still on my year out, I started up like a publication called Birthday Magazine, which...
That's incredible.
Thank you so much. It was like, I was given money by like O2 Think Big and a charity called Vinspired. They like sponsored me to do it. I don't even know if they still exist now, but it was a different time where, like, you know, they gave me like £300 and £500 respectively to like create this whole magazine, which I used to like distribute in hair shops. And then that really just cemented that I wanted to be a journalist. But what was really interesting in terms of how hard it was to get a job was, you know, it was so hard to get a job because it was so hard to get work experience. And I feel like birth came around because I didn't have, I couldn't get work experience. Like, I honestly don't know how many like internships I applied for. It has to be in the hundreds, because I would, you know, I just copy and paste like my, the same
company
a million times, but it had to be in the hundreds. And, I was so like desperate to get, I literally was going through my old like emails the other day in terms of where I'd applied to, and I found I'd applied at this place called like Gambling Insider. Because that I literally applied and was like, please, anybody, like, I'd applied to like all these different places and just been like, can somebody hire me? Like literally agricultural titles, anything, anybody that would have me. And I didn't get anything. So I remember starting up Birthday,
my magazine. That's incredible. Can I just pause there? That I love that. You're like, I know, I can't find a placement, so I'm just going to start a whole magazine. That's pretty incredible. It just shows how your mind works and your determination. And also, I wanted to ask you, because you sort of said it quickly, but it is quite important. You said you suffered from depression. Yeah. What triggered that?
I'd probably say, gosh, let me think. What triggered it? That is difficult. I guess it was a myriad of things. I think it was being away from home. I think it was a very different environment. I think I was struggling with a course I didn't like. I struggled with, like, you know, I had an amazing group of friends, but, you know, even outside of feeling very alienated within like a culture and community that I didn't really fit into at uni, I also felt that like even the spaces that I guess were there to kind of make you feel more comfortable, like the ACS, the Afro-Caribbean Society, I don't know, I think, you know, ACS is actually kind of have a reputation for often being becoming quite toxic. I'm not really quite sure why, but they can be, like, I guess especially in like elite institutions where there are, where people, you know, definitely struggle with respectability politics, with the idea of like you have to present yourself in a particular way in a particular space as like, you know, the few black people there, which is something I've never really adhered to or had any interest in. So there would be times where, you know, even at the ACS, which is, you know, supposed to be, a lot of the ACS members were black, were working class, almost entirely, but, and a lot of them were state school educated, but it still was like, in order to fit into this institution, you have to behave a particular way, which I just didn't particularly like. So I think just generally,
it was like a number of things.
Yeah, there was just loads and loads of things.
Yeah.
And I remember being so confused because I thought, surely you have to have a real reason to be depressed. But then I realized that's not how depression works. Like,
no, it doesn't.
things can just happen.
Yeah, and what's lovely is that out of it, you know, you started your magazine, which is pretty incredible.
Yeah, exactly.
It's very inspirational. And soon after that, if I'm correct, you then went on to write your famous book, Slay in Your Lane.
Yes, co-wrote with my friend from university who I met at Warwick.
Yeah, and tell me how that started.
So basically, gosh, where do I even begin in terms of that? So that book really was, gosh, I mean, we had the conversation in 2015, but Elizabeth had said before that it was like, you know, the culmination of like lots of frustrations over the years. Because when we left, Elizabeth graduated in 2013. I took the year out, so I graduated in 2014. And Slay in Your Lane was discussed in 2015. And, you know, we were both graduates and in our first jobs. And Elizabeth was in the corporate space and I was in journalism and the media, which is like characterized as far more open and liberal. But, you know, I was still facing lots of the same hurdles and issues as Elizabeth was. But I also was facing my own like individual hurdles, and she had her own individual hurdles that we just felt that, you know, as Black women, we were continually finding ourselves up against. And it was just really frustrating. So Elizabeth had been reading all these books like Girl Boss and by Sheryl Sandberg. Girl Boss by Sophia Maruso and Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg and Thrive by Huffington. And she was like, oh, these books are amazing. And, you know, they speak about being a woman in the workplace and navigating that. But she was like, you know, obviously as a Black woman, there's this elephant in the room in terms of my experience. And that doesn't necessarily feel reflected by these books. So she was just like, yeah, like it would be great if like there was a book that kind of like accurately, you know, depicted my experience and like advised on how to navigate like these particular the particular kind of issues that I'm facing as a young Black British woman. So she basically said to me, can you do me this small favor of like writing this book that like would speak to my experiences and advise me on how to like essentially slay in my lane? And at that point I was like, I don't have to stay in my lane either. So we definitely have to like, but even together, we were, both of us were still like, you know, she was 22, I was 23. And I was like,
it's incredible that we were that young, by the way.
Really young. So we were like, we really need to like speak to those who have actually done it already. And like, get their advice, which is how we ended up interviewing the 39 Black British trailblazing women on like their journey.
That is incredible. Just the fact that you were like so young, and again, it's similar to your experience with your magazine, that you were like, right, well, I can't get a placement, so I'm going to start a magazine. And it's like, right, I'm not seeing, you know, what I should be seeing in books, so we're going to start one. And that's really, really incredible. How did you guys approach all these different women? And was it hard, or did you know some of them?
We didn't actually know anybody to start with at all. The only person that I'd actually met before was Vivi Brown, the musician who I'd interviewed for the Huffington Post, and basically kind of reached out to her again and sort of said, hi, would really love to, you know, we haven't got a book deal, but we have this book idea and we've written a proposal and we'd really love to interview you for it. And she sort of was like, yeah, that's fine. But other than her, who I'd met like once, everybody else we've never actually spoken to at all. You know, with Charlene White, I used to work at Channel 4 at the time. Channel 4 News rather. So I was in the same building as her because I was at Grays Inn Road where, you know, ITV News and you know what I mean? Like Channel 5, they all
I know.
Building. So she like literally came into the toilets and I just asked her for her email.
Oh, that's amazing. I love that.
Yeah, she was amazing. And she was just like, well, we'll have the same, you know, like format of email because I'm like, you know, in ITN as well. And so she was like, just look at your email format and just, you know, write like my name and send an email. And sure enough, I did. And then with like Vanessa Kingori, who was the publisher at GQ back then and is now the publisher at Vogue. And then with June Sarpong, we went to this event called the Afro Hair and Beauty Show Live, which is like an annual event it celebrates like, you know, not even celebrates, it's like, I mean, it does by proxy celebrate, but it's, you know, like where loads of hair and beauty, black beauty vendors like come and sell their goods. It's like an annual thing. So June Sarpong was there campaigning against Brexit, actually. And we basically saw her and just asked her if we could, you know, interview her for this book that didn't exist. And she was like, yeah, ask my agent who was standing next to her. Can you like, ask my manager or agent for my email address? And we like expected fully to get a fake one, but sure enough, it was the real email address. So yeah.
That is so cool. That's just, I love it. I can imagine you both just going over there. It takes a lot of confidence to do that. Mm-hmm. Where do you think that came from? Did you have that confidence, or was it like fake it till you make it type thing?
Definitely fake it till you make it. I think that confidence came from necessity, to be honest. It was very much a situation where we just, I guess, just didn't really have a choice, because we're just like, if we want to actually get this done, we have no choice but to ask. And I guess it came very much from a, what is the worst thing that can happen? What is the worst outcome? So we just were like, if they say no, and I think as well, like being a journalist, I was very used to like being told no and like rejection in terms of getting into the industry for jobs, but then even rejection for like, you know, you're reaching out to people constantly and some people just don't necessarily want to do what you're asking of them. So I'm very used to having to like push. So I wasn't, you know, yeah, I guess it really did come out of like, we really need the best people for this book. And the absolute worst thing that can happen is they say they don't want to do it, which is fine and had happened before. But thankfully, I don't know how, like, you know, I guess it's just testament to how much black women want to see other black women win, because so many of them said yes before we had a book deal.
Yeah, but it's also, I think, a testament to the book itself, the idea behind it of how you structured it and everything else. I think for me, I definitely thought it was very inspirational, and I just loved how you also put your own circumstance and your own sort of words into there. You could have just stopped at just interviewing these women, but you also sort of put your own words to it.
Thank you.
How did that kind of process come about? So did you just like go, right, we're going to go and interview all these different women and then sort of work out the plan for the book, or did that come before?
So I guess, I think it came before, because we were just kind of like, I realized when writing the book that I'm a really organized person. I never thought I was before. Yeah, and surprisingly.
I love that.
Yeah, because I thought I was very go with the flow, but like, you know, I really was actually quite methodical in terms of like, okay, I had like a spreadsheet. I remember sending a spreadsheet which had like basically every visible black British woman that I could think of. It was like in the hundreds, and just wrote down their name and like would like color code whether we'd like reached out to them, whether it mattered that, like, you know, was this industry going to be represented? Did we need, say, 4 like TV presenters if there were only going to be 2 scientists or what? Like, just trying to work out along that basis. And I mean, initially the book was just going to be a workbook. It was literally just going to be about being a black woman navigating a particular space. Then we kind of drill down into it has to be specifically aimed at black British women, because that's a really invisibilized experience. Then it became, okay, let's do the research. And we realized that, oh, actually there are no books really that speak to, in an advisory sense, speak to the, you know, black women in education, black women in relationships, in terms of health. There just wasn't anything. So we were like, maybe we should like expand this out. And that's how it became the Black Girl Bible. And then again, as I said, like when we kind of realized we didn't necessarily have the expertise ourselves to really give that advice, that's when it became important that we kind of extrapolated that out and looked to those who've already done it for their advice. So yeah, I think, you know, it definitely changed as time went on, because initially we only had the one education chapter. Then we were like, oh wait a minute, university is super crucial, we need something on that. That wasn't like an initial thing. Even health, I think mental health became like, it was an additional chapter, like we hadn't really thought of it initially. But as time went on, the book just grew and changed shape. But yeah, it was very much like a, I think, like quite a well thought out like process, and it would naturally like kind of adapt over time.
Yeah, and I think it really shows. And when did you come up with a title, Slay in Your Lane? Was that from the beginning, or did it come after?
So the title came literally about 2 weeks, probably less than, after we had the conversation about the fact we were really going to do the book. Elizabeth had sent a picture of Solange Knowles, Beyonce.
Oh, yeah.
And like she'd captioned it, just because we used to send each other pictures of like, you know, celebrities just looking amazing all the time, and she'd like sent me one of Solange and was captioned it like Selena Lane. And then I called her and was like, oh my god, that's the name of the book, just because like A, it was like super catchy, but and we'd never seen it anywhere else, which is why we have like the Twitter handle, we have the Instagram handle, we have like handles, because we're just like, yeah, like, you know, this is definitely something we want to use, and no one else seems to be using. But also I think just, you know, in terms of what it means to be a Black woman in Britain today, like really just carving out your own path, defining success on your own terms. But then also, like, you know, when you look at Solange Knowles and how she's been able to create her own identity and become her own person away from, like, you know, Beyonce, who is like arguably the biggest artist in the world, I think play on that, and just about your own definition of success. So yeah, we just thought it fit really nicely.
I couldn't agree more. I think I absolutely love, and I remember seeing it and it just stood out compared to all the other books, and I just thought, what a brilliant rallying cry as well. It was just like within that one sentence, you just kind of captured the energy, and also the importance for people to just like, let's not compete against each other. Let's try and just make that lane the best lane ever. Yeah. I also saw that you, when you pitch your book to different publishers, you had quite a big surprise in terms of how the amount of money that they offered you.
Yes, we did. In terms of, like, I guess the first surprise was how many offers that we got, because we had 10 offers and we genuinely...
It's incredible.
Like, thank you so much. We would have been happy with like 4. We really would have, but we ended up with 10. And then one of them, our agent was like, financially, they're not going to be able to compete with the other offers. So like they declined that, which led to a 9-way bidding war, which was just... insane. So we were really like surprised by that. And then when it came down to, you know, like what we were offered, like we were just amazed, I suppose, because it's not like something that, you know, we were working full time, and we didn't think this is something that, like, you know, we're doing necessarily to make loads of money, because, you know, we truly felt like the likelihood wasn't that, you know, I think advances for debut authors aren't always amazing. And it's not like, you know, it was necessarily, it's interesting, the concept of life-changing money, because it's like, it wasn't life-changing in the sense of like, oh wow, we've like won the lottery or anything, but it was life-changing in the sense that like, it's meant that, like, I don't know. So it gave me a financial freedom that meant that I was able to, lose my job. I was able to leave my job. It's meant that like things like, you know, my savings and ensuring that I'm like financially stable, and that, you know, things like property and stuff that I want to like buy, like, you know, it definitely is part of why I'm able to do those things now, because of that first advance. So
yeah. But it must have also been like so lovely to see that what you created just resonated, and, you know, it must have given you so much confidence, like, yeah, we're onto the right path here.
Yeah, definitely, absolutely. Because I think when it comes to minority experiences, it's very, they're often considered like, they're very sidelined, and they're often seen as niche, and they're often seen as, you know, a specific story that only will appeal in the mainstream to certain people, and you have to be of that demographic to want to read about those experiences.
That's
so
right.
we were very, you know, we were very specific about wanting to make a mainstream book that was by Black women and for Black women, but still, you know, I'd always say, like, I don't like the idea of like a bookshop apartheid, where it's like, this is the Black section and everything else is like everything else, and we're all expected to read from the other parts, but when it comes to the so-called Black books, those are just for Black people to read. So we were very clear in the fact that we wanted this to be a book that spoke to essentially black, it spoke to black women, but at the end of the day, experiences are universal. So for black women, we wanted it to validate our experiences. And then we wanted for people that aren't black to sort of learn from it and like educated by it. So I think, yeah, like the advance and the, you know, the level of interest from publishers definitely validated that these stories are marketable in the mainstream. I think it really, I think it's, you know, there have been several books off the back of it that have been, you know, I always say that publishing is very much a bandwagon industry. Like it's almost like fast fashion. Like, you know, there's a lot of like, it's happening. So we're doing this as well. And there are loads of books that have basically been sold in as like versions of Slaying Your Lame, which I think it is definitely testament to the fact that this is like, you know what I mean, a mainstream book.
Completely. I couldn't agree more. I think you succeeded completely. I would say it was the book of 2018. And when I saw it on the bookshelves, I didn't think, you know, it wasn't a book for me. In fact, there's quite a few women in there that I knew, like Karen Blackett. And I was like, oh, I really want to see about her story. And I think it's brilliant that you did that. And it's quite a compliment to your book that you had some copycats afterwards.
Yeah, you know, definitely. Yeah.
I know you've got to go because you're super, super busy. So I'm just going to ask you one last question. What's next for you? You have done so much stuff. You've got another book out. You've interviewed so many great people like Issa Rae, Naomi Campbell. And obviously you've got your podcast. You know, what's next?
Gosh, I think, to be honest, I'm not really sure. And I think that's kind of exciting because I feel like in terms of journalism, like, honestly, I've been saying to everybody, like, I don't even know who next I will interview that will kind of like excite me as much as like Issa Rae and like Naomi Campbell. Like, because honestly, I don't know, between like Beyonce and Rihanna, those are like the two people I think are left on my wish list at this point. Cause I honestly have been lucky enough to interview so many, specifically black women as well, that I really look up to, such as like Megan Thee Stallion and like Issa Rae and people that really inspire me. So that's been incredible. But I think, yeah, just in terms of like what I'm doing next, I've really been doing a lot of stuff that's quite different in terms of like hosting and like working within like TV and like doing things that are slightly like outside of my comfort zone. I started writing like fiction over lockdown.
Oh, wow.
Like, yeah, it looks like since we're going into like a second lockdown,
yeah,
I can continue. So yeah, I don't really know what's next. I just know that I'm going to be doing a lot of different stuff, which is very exciting.
That is very exciting. And in terms of imparting any advice to people listening to this podcast, I mean, you could even say Slaying Your Lame is still a very good piece of advice.
Yeah, like I think Slaying in Your Lame definitely is a great piece of advice. I think, you know, I always say authenticity over everything. Like, you know, that it sounds very Disney and very cliche, but like, there is only one you. But I think that is why we had such success with Slaying Your Lame. We saw what was hiding in plain sight, and I think there is often a real push for people to do what, like, we'll just regurgitate what's already out there when you are willing to take risks and do what feels and comes authentically to you. Like, you know, most, pretty much anything that's happened in my career that's been amazing has been because it's something that I've truly been engaged with and I've truly thought would be interesting and amazing, and I've just done it like on that basis of this feels right to me. And usually, like, even if it takes some time for people to catch up, I mean, Slaying Your Lame, it's literally 5 years since that conversation now. I feel like, yeah, it doesn't matter. Like, as long as you are doing what feels authentic to you, at least one person will be happy, and that'll be yourself. Whereas often when you try to emulate other people and stuff, nobody's happy because somebody else is already doing it.
Yeah. Oh my God. That is so, so true. I'm the same with this podcast. I love interviewing people like you. And even if there's only one person that listens to it, that's all right by me. So on that note, thank you so, so much. I let you go to do all the myriads of things that you're doing. But yeah, thank you.
I appreciate that. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of This Way Up. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. Please look out for more empowering interviews in the weeks to come. Now, I have a couple of special favors to ask. Firstly, if you've enjoyed this conversation, then please subscribe on iTunes and leave a review. It really helps generate exposure for the podcast. and allows a wider audience to get access to these really important topics. Secondly, if you know of anyone else that would enjoy this show and benefits from the topics I cover, then do please share the podcast. By sharing this with just a couple of people, it will just help spread the good message and hopefully support the women this podcast was designed to reach. Finally, if you can follow This Way Up podcast, or one word, on Instagram, you'll get notified of future episodes. And the idea is that together we can build a powerful community and hopefully start to change the creative industry. That's it from me. Until next time. You love me, thank you. You love me, thank you.